And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Ussery, and it's my pleasure to welcome Tova Mervis back to the program today. Tova has published three novels, The Lady's Auxiliary, The Outside World, and Visible City. But today we'll be talking about her memoir, which deals with her ending her marriage at the same time she questions her commitment to modern Orthodox Judaism. It's called The Book of Separation, which is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Tova, when you were last here for your novel, Visible City, you just had an essay in the New York Times about your divorce. Were you already working on the memoir at that point?
I think the idea of memoir really scared me. I really think of myself so much as a fiction writer, and I love the feeling of invention that, of course, you borrow things from your own life, but really you take it and create something new. And so I don't think I thought I could write a memoir. I was really nervous about it, but I had written an essay about my Orthodox Jewish divorce ceremony in which I came to really realize that I was leaving a religious world that had always shaped me. And the essay was published in the New York Times, and it was very nerve-wracking to put something so personal and so private out into the world. And through a series of happenstance coincidences, I was in Costa Rica the week that the essay came out, and I've learned one thing as a writer. It's that when you put your most personal, private story in the New York Times, a rainforest is a very good place to be. And eventually I came home, and I had hundreds of emails from people who had read the essay, and they were sharing with me their own stories of leaving a marriage or leaving a particular way of life or leaving a religious community or maybe not leaving but wondering if the life they were living was the one that really matched who they were. And I just read through email after email, and it was really the most moving experience I've had as a writer. It reminded me of why I write. It reminded me that when you are willing to put something honest and something that makes you vulnerable out into the public, it enables people to connect with it. And I think that for me was really the turning point when I decided that I did want to write a memoir. I wanted to write the longer version of this story, even though it made me feel so vulnerable.
Now, a 700-word essay is much different than a 300-page memoir.
Yes, it is.
What did you find the most difficult part of that process?
Well, it's funny. I started off with this essay, which was this finished story. And an essay is sort of a small slice of life. And, of course, a memoir is so much larger. And I really had to put aside that essay. I had to really, you know, it wasn't in my everyday writing file because that told one story. And I needed to take it apart before I could come back to any kind of finished story. And so for years, I didn't think about that essay. It was what motivated me. And ultimately, a part of that essay is the starting point of the memoir. But I had to really be willing to delve into the unfinished parts and to look at a story that, on one hand, the Book of Separation follows the first year of living outside of the Orthodox Jewish community that has always shaped me. But it also flashes back in time because I wanted to look not just at what I was leaving, but what for so long had held me inside this world and what then and always keeps me connected to it as well.
So why did you adopt that nonlinear structure when it came to telling the story?
The structure for me is always the most exciting part of writing, and it's also the most complicated. I feel like it's trying to build a book. I think of it in terms of structure, of how you would structure a house or a bridge or how you build something. And when I was writing the Book of Separation, I would write events on note cards, and there were present day events and then there were past events. I thought of it as there's the far past and the near past. I had this elaborate system inside my head that sometimes I would put on these note cards and spread across the living room floor. And of course, I would have to give everyone directions like, do not walk in there. My book is laying across the floor. And I felt like, you know, to tell it fully chronologically put a lot of weight on the idea of early years. I didn't want it to be like, and then I was in fourth grade, and then I was in fifth grade, and then I was in high school. I really wanted to look at those moments of rupture, moments when we take leave of something, and then zigzag. And so I spent a lot of time thinking about how the past gets folded into our present. And of course, in life, we do that all the time. We have an event that happens to us, and our minds naturally travel back to a time that this reminds us of, or a time that explains why we are where we are today. And so I wanted to sort of mimic that natural feeling that in our minds, in the way we understand and come to understand our own personal stories, I think we always move between the present and the past.
Have you ever had a Proustian petite madeleine?
Right, yes. Yes, I have. You know, that sense of what I think so much of writing memoir is trying to do exactly what the Madeleine does, that feeling of how do I evoke those early memories? How do I not just remember them, but re-experience them. How do I put myself back in the mind of my earlier self and really ask myself those hard questions of, well, why? Why was I this way when I was 16? And what did that feel like? And what did it feel like to be 22? And then what did it feel like to be 30? To really, I think, to have that visceral experience of an earlier time.
Now, there were people in the Orthodox community who had criticized your fiction for not being Orthodox enough and for your characters having doubts about their lives and their faith and their religion. What's the feedback been so far since you've just laid out your life on the line for them to read as well?
Right. It was interesting. I think I learned maybe as a trial by fire with my first novel, The Ladies' Auxiliary, which was set in the Memphis Orthodox Jewish community where I grew up. And all of us, I think, present ourselves a certain way. We all have our public selves, our sort of outer facades. But I think, you know, really the magic of fiction is that we get to go inside. We get to see people in their inner lives, in those spaces that are messy and complicated. And I think that cuts across any religious community, any location, any family. There's always that inner story. And I think that's what I'm most interested in as a writer. And so when I wrote The Ladies' Auxiliary, there were people who felt like, within the Memphis Jewish community, that it was either nice or not nice. It was negative. It was positive. And I think I learned so much as a writer through that experience that, you know, of course, the writer writes one particular story. It's seeing the world through my eyes. And the reader comes at that story with their own particular story. The reader brings the things they are passionate about, the things they are angry about, the things that scare them to those words. And we react based on those things. And so I think I had to learn with Ladies' Auxiliary that I couldn't account for reaction and I couldn't control it. And I tried not to take it into account in my writing because I didn't want it to hold me back from pushing myself toward being honest, toward being willing to write the things that maybe make us uncomfortable sometime, but that are true about what it means to be part of any human community. And so with this book, it just came out a few weeks ago, so it's still in that new stage. But I have been getting a lot of reaction, mostly through email and Facebook messages at this point. And I find that I've gotten emails, as I did with the first essay that originated this book, I've gotten emails from people from all religious backgrounds, people who are struggling to belong to a religious community or people who've left. You know, just in the past few weeks, I got an email from a man who was part of a Mormon community and who is getting divorced and said that he gave an excerpt of the book to his parents to read to explain to them his own story. I've gotten emails from someone in a Southern Baptist community who's getting a divorce and feels that she is somehow being shunned because of it. And I think so many people across every religious world have to ask themselves, do I not just belong to this world, but do I believe in it? And what does it mean if I don't? And what are the benefits and what are the losses of striking out on my own? And so from within the Jewish community, too, I would say there's always a varied reaction. There's never a single, you know, sort of monolithic Orthodox reaction or Jewish reaction. And I've received many, many nice emails from people in the Jewish community who wanted to share with me their sense that they too question where they belong or what it means to not be sure if you believe in something you've been raised to believe. And of course, there are these other emails. I think one of the things I've learned also as a writer is you never read the comments on an essay. And so when an excerpt of the Book of Separation appeared in the New York Times a few weeks ago, I responded to all the personal emails, but I don't read the comments. I just feel like, you know, I'm going to put my story out there, but those comments people dash off, I'm not going to engage with those.
I remember last time you said a friend of yours had read them and kind of reported them to you. Does she still do that for you?
A friend did read them. My oldest son was very interested in reading them this time. He's 18, and he's like, can I argue with people in the comments section? I was like, if you want to, you'll enjoy it. Don't feel like you need to. I think some people enjoy that sort of like combat that, you know, let me diss you and then you diss me and I'll go back and forth. I don't enjoy that. I'm happy to have a thoughtful conversation, but not the sort of like little war of words about who's right and who's wrong.
So has your son read the book?
My children have read parts of it. They are very aware that they are pieces of the book. You know, I felt like really it's my own story and it's my own story I wanted to expose. But of course, they're so much a part of my life and I'm so deeply connected to them that our stories overlap. So we've had a lot of conversations about the book. And as they get older, when they choose to read it, they can. Actually, they hadn't read any of my novels. I once tried to get my oldest son to read The Ladies' Auxiliary. And he likes a lot of fantasy and adventure novels. And he read a page and he's like, oh, it's kind of boring.
So you've changed the name of everybody in the book except for yourself. Did you allow your children to select the names that they would be called?
I did change all the names. I felt like I wanted some sense of privacy, whatever that means. And when you write a book like this, I felt like I wanted there to be a gap created between my real life children and family members and friends and the people in the book. And so it was actually sort of fun to come up with names. I did allow some feedback in terms of the names they were going to pick. My sons wanted to be named after football players. There was a place where I had to draw the line and I gave them some options. But we've had fun sort of joking around with everyone's assumed names. And in readings, I have to always remind myself when I answer questions to use the made-up names because, of course, it's so natural for me just to refer to everyone by their real names.
In the course of the Book of Separation, your middle child, his name is Josh in the book, seems to have problems with his religious school that he's attending and has more questions and more defiance about attending religious services. You yourself were a middle child. Do you think there's something about the middle child that leans toward that?
Right. That's funny. These middle children who are always in that position of, you know, are you this way? Are you that way? Maybe you're caught between things. And, you know, I think one of the things I was really interested in the book is thinking about parenting and really in the book thinking about my own position. Maybe it's a different kind of middle child position of being both a daughter and a mother, that feeling of being betwixt and between. And I wanted to write about that question. Maybe middle children are more prone to it. I wonder if we don't have established roles quite the same way as the oldest and the youngest do. But I wanted to write about that parenting quandary of what happens when, you know, you raised your children, when they're babies, you are sort of their entire world and they're your entire world and you know everything they know and you feel like, oh, I've taught them what they know. But of course, children go out into the world and they begin to learn things and they have other influences. And they begin to think for themselves. And I think that idea for a parent maybe is the most radical of any in parenting, that our children become their own people. And they take what we give them, but they make it their own. And they get to choose how they live, and they get to choose what they believe in. And I think certainly as my kids get older, I think about how in parenting, there's so much the urge to hold them close, to keep them close at hand, to shelter them and protect them. But I think the real challenge of parenting as kids get older is that we also have to let go and have to let go and allow them to become themselves. And one of the things that I thought a lot about in the experiences that I wrote about and in writing the book was that I wanted to be able to be my authentic self. I didn't want to tell my children things and teach them and enforce rules that I knew I didn't really believe in or not sufficiently. I didn't want to have that feeling that I'm saying one thing to you, to these three little people that I love more than anything, but privately, I don't know if I think it's true. I wanted to be able to parent with my most authentic self because I want my children to become their most authentic selves. And I think when we parent that way, we have to accept that sometimes it means that our kids don't believe as we do, or they don't observe the same rules, or they don't believe in the same ideals, or they don't vote for the same political candidates. They become their own people. And I think the challenge of parenting is to love regardless of that, so that there are not a series of litmus tests that you must be like me in order for me to love you.
Now, I've talked with authors before that I've interviewed about their novels and then get to talk to them about memoirs that come mm-hmm. afterwards. But you're in a unique situation because I've actually met your mother and talked with her several
times.
The whole
family.
It was strange in that regard. I only know her in a professional sense. She used to volunteer with our station. Very kind woman, wonderful performer. But it was just a bit odd seeing into both of your lives like that.
Right. There's the sense that a memoir really lays bare, you know, the family world. And, you know, I think with my parents, you know, I think that what I have learned as a parent, I've learned so much from my own parents. We were very much part of the modern Orthodox community in Memphis, and they really instilled in us a deep sense of belonging to that world. And yet I feel like my parents have also given me as well as my siblings the gift of allowing us to become ourselves and allowing us to know that we are all still deeply connected as a family and that you don't have to match in order to have a family and to have that sense of family connection.
And they were on the more progressive side of modern Orthodoxy here in town.
They are, yes. You know, you could probably divide the Jewish world or the Orthodox world into so many subsets and subcategories, but I would definitely put them on the more liberal edge of modern Orthodoxy.
Just briefly, what's the main difference between modern Orthodoxy, ultra, and right-wing Orthodoxy?
Sure. There are all these terms sort of attempting to define this world that spans a somewhat wide spectrum. And the way I always think about it or explain the difference between modern orthodoxy and ultra-orthodoxy, or sometimes it's called more right-wing orthodoxy, is really the relationship to the secular world and to the outside world. And ultra-orthodoxy is less likely to be involved and engaged in the outside world in terms of engagement with secular culture, with secular education, with college, with secular books. And as you go more toward modern orthodoxy, there's a greater engagement with secular culture. And so modern orthodoxy would believe in the idea that you can remain strictly religious and part of a traditional religious community and still be engaged with secular culture and secular education and secular values, and that the goal or the attempt is to somehow combine those or bring those together so that they can coexist inside you.
So do you think the metaphor of your novel, of looking out the window and seeing other people's lives, was that in your process of doubt looking to the wider world?
It's interesting for me to think about how much Visible City is a part of this memoir. I wrote Visible City really when I moved from Manhattan to a suburb of Boston. And as soon as I moved, I was so overcome with homesickness for New York City. And one of the things I really loved about living in New York was watching people out their windows and in the streets, where just to take a walk was to see so many interesting things. And there was always this possibility of a chance encounter, always this feeling that something of interest could happen. And I'm always a people watcher. I think being a novelist is to have that eye always trained on other people, or to be really curious about, you know, what's going on there or what's that about, and to really be interested in, as I said, that inner life of other people. And so I think maybe Visible City for me was about that question of how we experience ourselves and how we look out at other possibilities, and to think about the ways that what we imagine of other people's lives, the idea that there are other ways to live, I think we aren't just watching something, but we're asking a question that's particular to ourselves. And I think in Visible City, I was asking the question of what does it mean to look out at other people's lives when maybe you want to avoid something about your own life.
When you were having doubts about your religion and the unhappiness about your marriage, were you able to think about those in separate terms, or were they just inextricably linked?
You know, I've thought about that question a lot. I think that they were very intertwined. And I think that maybe the same mechanisms that kept me inside one kept me inside the other. I think that for a long time, I was afraid to ask some very hard questions. I think that change is enormously scary. And I think maybe we intuitively know those things that if I look at that, I might have to do something about it. And I wasn't ready to ask questions in both those regards. I was very committed to the idea that I couldn't go to things that scared me, because I was afraid of a change. I was afraid of knowing something that I didn't really want to know, or maybe I wasn't ready to know. And I think so much of what the Book of Separation is about is that question of how we put aside questions in our lives and what happens when we're ready to face them. I was really interested in the idea of late doubt. It was a term I kept sort of tossing around in my head for years, where we might think our lives look a certain way and might feel like everything is set in place. But I think there come moments, for me, it was around the age of turning almost 40, where I had that sort of resurgence of, wait, is this how I want it to look? Am I really living a life that feels truly authentic to who I am? And it creates upheaval, I think, to ask those questions. And one of the things I've learned, though, is that, you know, my earlier wish that somehow I could make it through unscathed, I could make it through without asking hard questions, I think that for so many of us, there comes that moment when we have to ask those questions.
And do you remember when you were younger, when you first had inklings of doubt?
I remember being a high school student at the Yeshiva of the South here. I was always like a daydreamer. I was always very inside my head. I was a reader. I'd always wanted to be a writer. And I remember being aware that there was sort of a subterranean voice that would somehow sort of step out sometimes and ask, you know, really? Or do I really think that? Or I think I was aware of the feeling that to ask questions rendered you a so-called bad girl. And I was very aware that there was a very strong urge to be the good girl, to do what you were supposed to do and to think what you were supposed to think. And any sense that somehow you deviated from that rendered you bad. And I think that was very much imprinted on me, this idea that there was one way to be good and there were so many ways you could be bad.
Well, and you note in the book that your name means good.
I know,
in
irony,
Hebrew.
Right?
Well, I think there's a term called nominal determinism.
Exactly.
And I was just wondering, I mean, did that play a part in your thinking that, you know, I am literally named good. I don't have any options.
Right. It's so funny. If I were writing this as a novel and I decided to name the character who struggles with this question of what it means to be good and bad, if I decided to give her a Hebrew name of Tova, which means good, my editor would cross it out and say, oh, this is way, you know, overdetermined. This is way too, you know, heavy-handed and symbolic. And so there's the irony that, of course, that is my name. And I do think it's interesting how our names weigh on us, even though I was named after a great grandmother. But I did have that awareness of it wasn't just what I was supposed to be, but it was really the definition of who I was. And I think in the Book of Separation, I really wanted to ask the question of what happens when you stop equating being religious with being good. I was certainly raised to think that if I was religious in the way I had been taught, then I was automatically good. And of course, the opposite was true as well, that if I wasn't religious in this way, I could no longer be good. And I think one of the central questions of my memoir is, what happens when you let go of those categories? What happens when you stop thinking about the world as being defined into these fixed categories of you are good now and now you are bad, and really begin to ask a different set of questions?
Did you have any other instances in the narrative in which you were going, this might be a little too on the nose, but it's real?
Right. But it's so funny with fiction. I'm always so afraid of things that seem, you know, too perfect or too symbolic. But, you know, there was a moment where I wrote about it in the book where in the final year of my belonging to an Orthodox community, I had an experience at synagogue where I was wearing a hat, as I always did, and had this terrible headache. And it was sort of shocking in how intense it was and how strong it came over me. And so I sort of rushed out of the building. I was very concerned with what was going on, and I took off my hat, and the pain immediately went away. And so I wrote about that a little bit in the Book of Separation. But even as I wrote it, I thought, oh, this sounds like you're making it up. But it's really true. It really happened. But I think that it's strange. I mean, nonfiction in some ways hands you the material. It hands you your raw material. You're not inventing. But there is that same feeling of sometimes life hands you something that in fiction would not be believable.
And it was just amazing the problems you had finding hats and wigs as part of the fulfilling Orthodox requirements, and that because your hair is so naturally curly, that presented problems in getting something that would fit you.
I enjoyed writing about hair. I think I've always liked writing about hair as a metaphor for bodies, and certainly my hair can be a metaphor for unruliness or what happens when something won't lie flat or sit as it's supposed to do. And so I did write a lot about hair covering and women's hair in Orthodoxy. I was interested in how the laws within the Orthodox community are not just external laws. They're not written on pieces of paper, but I feel like they're really written across women's bodies, and they shape so much of what a woman is allowed to wear or how she's supposed to look. And so it's deeply personal. I feel like the act of covering my hair for the first few years when I got married was not this observance I did sometimes, but it was something I did every single day, and so it was always a part of me. And so when I felt a sense of not fully believing in what I was doing, it was as if I wasn't believing in a part of my own daily experience, my own body.
And that it's so on the nose that they could not make a wig to match your hair, that your hair was so individual
right.
and its curliness that it could not conform.
I tried very hard, believe me. I tried very hard to find one as curly as my hair, but apparently it was not to be found.
Now, there's another event that is just laden with symbolism, and it's kind of like the turning point of the book, and it's when you first start to drive on the expressway with William.
It's funny. I grew up driving, of course, in Memphis, and this is where I learned how to drive, and I had no issues driving in Memphis whatsoever. It was, you know, I was a 16-year-old driving my parents' car, happy as can be. And then I went to college in New York City, where for 14 years I didn't have a car and had really no need to drive. When we moved to Boston, all of a sudden driving became something that I needed to do again. And I was deeply afraid. Boston driving, I think, has many reasons why you should be afraid of it. It is not sort of a courteous, low-key driving city, but I was terrified of it. So on one hand, there was the very real struggle to really learn how to drive. I managed somehow to avoid driving on the expressway in Boston for 10 years. And it felt shameful, I feel like, to be afraid to do something that is so basic to so many people and so necessary. It felt like a metaphor for being stuck, for being afraid to do that which was necessary. And so the book does chart the willingness to start driving again. And, you know, that sense of fear, I think, can overtake you. I feel like it snuck up on me. All those years I lived in New York, I wouldn't have said I was afraid to drive, but I just didn't do it. And all of a sudden, before I knew it, I was afraid, and not actually in the book, but you know, I started to drive in the book. I learned how to go on the highway, even though I was so afraid. And one of the early times I was with my daughter, and I wanted to explain to her that I was afraid. I think children can pick up on those times when we are afraid, and I didn't want to pass on fear to them. And so I sort of told my daughter that, you know, we're going to pick up my mother at the airport, and I had to drive on the Mass Pike in Boston and was very afraid. And I want to make it okay for her to know that even grown-ups are afraid sometimes. And she looked at me and said, you know, Mommy, it's not like, you know, swimming in a river with crocodiles. And I was like, you're right, it's not. And, you know, I think we all find ways to overcome fear and find ways to take the things we're afraid of. And I think even when you're still afraid, you can do something. And I think a lot of the memoir is about seizing those things that are scary or that feel nerve-wracking to an individual for whatever reason and doing it anyway.
Very literally in the same vein, you talk about when you're younger, you drove across the causeway across Lake Pontchartrain outside of New Orleans. And I know many adults who are terrified to drive across that causeway.
Right. It's so funny. I remember that drive so clearly. A few friends and I drove down to New Orleans, and it was like this thrilling feeling. I actually was in New Orleans a few weeks ago, and it was a nice memory to sort of look back and to think, you know, when I was 18, I wasn't fearful. I felt like we were driving across the entire ocean, the sense that it was just so beautiful. And sometimes it's nice to remember that, you know, the fear wasn't always there. It came later, but I think it reminded me that it wasn't always going to stay, that kind of fear.
Now, for so many people, they turn to their faith when in a time of crisis. But when the crisis is literally losing your religion, who did you turn to?
Right. I think it is a sense of crisis. It's the sense that the thing that has defined me and that has always been who I am is no longer how I think of myself. And so I think that, you know, there were people I turned to. I felt like my parents were always immensely supportive, and a few close friends I felt like were always there. And I felt, too, that the person, though, that I really had to be able to turn to was myself. And for so long, I felt that gap between my inner and outer self, or felt this sense that the person I said I was not who I privately knew myself to be. And I think what I really wanted to explore in the book of Separation was that sometimes it's not necessarily belonging to an outer group or to a larger community, but sometimes that sense of self-acceptance and self-belonging can really see you through some very hard times.
Now, are there any practices or rituals that you've kept for yourself, not just to help with your children's going back and forth between an observant parent and a non-observant parent, anything you thought were valuable enough to keep for yourself?
I do. I remain deeply connected to the Boston Jewish community. And I feel like I don't have that sense that things are compelled or obligatory or that I have to do it so that I can belong. But I do remain very connected to many parts of Jewish tradition and Jewish ritual. In particular, the holidays is something that feels very meaningful to me as a time of a family gathering time and a way to connect to a sense of tradition. And I think for some of the holidays, I've tried to reinvent them for myself and do them in different ways. But a lot of them remain traditional. And I'm still very connected to a sense of Jewish history and Jewish text and Jewish culture. I think that, you know, when you leave something, you don't have to leave it entirely. And I think it's possible to leave and yet remain connected and to stay even as you're leaving.
If someone asks you the question, what is the status of your faith/religion, other than handing them a 300-page book, what do you tell them now?
I think I'd have to hand them the book. I know, it's funny. Very soon after people began to know that I was no longer part of the Orthodox community, people asked me, well, are you a conservative Jew now? Are you a Reformed Jew? Where do you fit in? And I feel like leave-taking doesn't happen like that. I feel like there's this state between where you stop being who you once were. I always think of it as like the stage of unbecoming before you become something else. And so I would really place myself in that category, no longer being who I once was, but still remaining connected to it. And so I think that maybe I shy away from the definitions because I don't have a good answer except to say I've got a book for you to read.
Recently, I've been kicking around this idea and that in some ways, since so many of our religious traditions are based on older texts going back hundreds, if not thousands of years, that perhaps our morality has outstripped our religions. And I was just wondering how much of the concepts of that have played a part in your doubts.
I think for me, it was feeling a gap between what my moral reckoning felt and what religious law taught. And I'll use the example of women's issues within Judaism to sort of illustrate that. Orthodox Judaism has somewhat of a range of relationship to feminism and women's role within it, but ultimately there are places where women are not included or counted or play secondary roles. And I understand, and for many years was part of an attempt to reframe it or think about it differently or not be bothered by it. I would tell myself, oh, it doesn't mean it that way. It's not really that. But for me, that constant need to reframe something and reshape it really shed light on the question of, well, what do I really think about that? And I was bothered by it. And it comes up in many issues, sort of social issues, about where I feel like the religious teachings that I was raised to think did not match my moral standpoint on things. And that, I think, was a very big part of the gap for me, this awareness that I knew I was supposed to say something or supposed to uphold a particular point of view, but I didn't really believe that. I think it creates a deep sense of cognitive dissonance where this sense of worlds at war with each other. And I hoped for a long time I could stay in that in-between state. I thought, well, I'll just let it be contradictory. And we live, of course, in so many ways where we live with a contradictory ideas or values. But for me, that sense of contradiction became too great not to really ask myself, well, what do I want to do about the fact that there is this gap?
So far on the book tour, have you gotten tired of talking about yourself?
It's so strange. I did a reading in Boston the other night. It was a lovely reading, a lovely crowd, and so many nice people were there. And the first person raised his hand and he said, I'm so sorry, but I wanted to ask you a personal question. And I just said, you know what? How can I fault you on that? I've written a memoir. And, you know, certainly in writing it, you know, every day, like writing the story, there were times I would just finish for the day and be like, I am so sick of myself, like anything but this. Because memoir is that feeling of your own story, mining it again and again and again. And certainly with the book coming out, you know, one of the things I've done is I'm not really reading any reviews, which I've never done for my novels. I didn't have the willpower to not read them. But with this, I'm not even tempted. It's sort of interesting. I hear about them and I get the little pull quote of nice things, which have been very nice. But I don't like reading the summary of my life. It feels too strange. And so I think that's one way I've tried to protect against it because, you know, there is something about with fiction, you get to talk about other people's lives, even though they're your own creations. You're inside other places and other worlds. That has definitely been one of the strangeness of this past few weeks, the sense that I am talking about my life.
Well, yeah, it's tough hearing people's thoughts of you instead of people's thoughts of your work.
Exactly. It's all intertwined. Even though you can talk about memoir as a literary construct and a structural issue, and I think you could have a conversation about that, but it so easily blends into the subject matter because that is, of course, the story of the book.
Now, people in the Memphis area will soon have an opportunity to see you speak about your book live and in person at the 2017 Jewish Literary and Cultural Arts Festival. You're kicking off on November 2nd. What do you anticipate you're going to be like that evening?
Coming to Memphis is always fun. Maybe I should confess, nerve-wracking. Also, it's easier, of course, for me to talk to a room of strangers than a room of family and friends. And so I think, you know, what I really want to talk about in the book is that it's not a book that wants to slash a world or wants to say, oh, I would never be part of it. I think it's a book that really wants to grapple with the question of what happens when we decide that we don't match any longer the world we were part of. And I think it's a question that people find themselves in so many places, and maybe we don't always know where we're going to end up. If you had told me 20 years ago I would have written this book, I would have been surprised. I wouldn't have expected that necessarily. And I hope it's a book that can open a conversation about how we deal with difference, how we deal with the fact that not everyone believes the same thing, and even the people we love the most don't believe the same thing. And what do we do then? How do we deal with those differences?
Well, Tove, I want to thank you so much for stopping by and sharing your memoir with us. And I'm looking forward to your next novel, too.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to getting back to fiction. I definitely have the ideas sort of percolating, and I'm ready to start writing.
Tove Mervis is the author of The Book of Separation, which is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. I'm Stephen Usery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.